It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our Curious Wisconsin segment. This week, we'll talk to a Washington Island resident about a modern Wisconsin incarnation of a classic European tradition, the Stave Church.
First, Wisconsin's Office of the Commissioner of Insurance announced this week that it would no longer enforce the state's contraception coverage mandate for employers with religious objections.
The commissioner pointed to last month's Supreme Court Hobby Lobby decision that excused that company from complying with a federal mandate to provide contraception coverage. Wisconsin has a state-specific law that requires companies to cover contraception, but the commissioner has said the Supreme Court decision effectively negates it. Birth control advocates in the state disagree, and legal expert Marcy Hamilton wrote a column today arguing against the commissioner's decision.
Marcy Hamilton is the chair of public law at the Yeshiva School of Law. Her forthcoming book is called God Versus the Gavel, The Perils of Extreme Religious Liberty. Marcy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what do you make of the Walker administration's decision to stop requiring insurers to cover contraception based on this recent Supreme Court Hobby Lobby decision?
Well, it's both an unconstitutional and misguided decision. It's very odd to see a state abandoning its own law for a case that only involved a federal statute that applies to federal law.
So why do you believe that is the case here in Wisconsin, that a Republican-controlled legislature, the Walker administration, I should say, has decided to make this move and follow a federal law instead of sticking with the state version?
Well, the federal law is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which only applies to federal laws. And what happened in Hobby Lobby is that it was used to undercut women's access to health care. But the federal law, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA, cannot be applied to state law, and that's because of a case that I actually had at the Supreme Court in 1997, where I represented the city of Boerne, Texas, and the Supreme Court held that RFRA may not be applied to state law. So it is simply unconstitutional for the state to now say they can't enforce their contraception mandate because of this federal RFRA.
How common are state-specific laws requiring companies to cover contraception around the country?
There are about 30 states that have such a requirement, and in those states, the Hobby Lobby decision should have no impact whatsoever. Now, some states do have their own state-level RFRAs, but Wisconsin's not one of them. It's been proposed several times, but the Wisconsin legislature has never enacted a state-level RFRA. And so the law that was in place under state law for contraception before Hobby Lobby should be identical to the law that's being enforced today.
Are we seeing anything like this, though, in any of these other states, saying that they can no longer uphold the state laws in light of Hobby Lobby?
No, on this issue at least, Wisconsin is now in the vanguard. It is the first state that has tried to cut back on women's contraception access based on state law. And it's indefensible, and I would assume other states have at least read the relevant cases at the Supreme Court to know that they can't do it.
Now, a spokesperson for Wisconsin's Office of Insurance has said that the Supreme Court's Hobby Lobby decision means that Wisconsin can't enforce the law and that they actually have no choice in this matter. What do you make of that reasoning?
Well, it's just wrong. You know, sometimes lawyers are wrong, and here they're really wrong. As I said, he cannot use the Hobby Lobby decision, which is about federal RFRA applied to federal law, to undermine state law. And essentially what the Walker administration is doing here is they are overriding the Wisconsin state legislature's own statutes. There's no justification for it. And I assume that the people of Wisconsin and the legislature are going to be unhappy that their own law has been undermined, and it's unconstitutional to do that.
Is this perhaps a case of the Office of Insurance trying to get out ahead of the curve and saying, you know, we've already seen this Hobby Lobby decision, so the Wisconsin law will not hold up any longer. It will fall in court, so we're just going to start, you know, acting as such, being preemptive about it.
Well, there's nothing that could make it fall in court. The Supreme Court made it very clear that the decision interpreting RFRA was based on RFRA and that it is not what the First Amendment requires. Under Wisconsin state law, the state statute is perfectly constitutional. Under the federal constitution, it's perfectly constitutional. So for them to try to get out ahead of it is they're way ahead of themselves. And, you know, they're basically asking for costly federal litigation to find out that they should have read a 1997 decision at the United States Supreme Court.
Do you expect to see any states following suit?
Well, only states where there is a state RFRA. And what they'll do is they'll try to argue that their state RFRA should be interpreted just like the federal RFRA. That's a reach. It's a real stretch, but I would imagine they will. But for the states without a state RFRA, there's just no justification for this.
So if Wisconsin, say, wanted to exempt insurers from covering contraceptives, would you argue that the better path to choose would have been to establish a Wisconsin RFRA?
Well, a RFRA is never the better path. It is always a law that leads down paths that no one's ever imagined that end up harming other people. But if they would like to change the state law that governs whether or not women are going to have their contraception covered, then they should consider amending the state law. As I understand it, that was on the table introduced by the Republicans, but it's never been passed. So this was an end run around the political process that the Republicans had attempted to use to try to undermine access of contraception for women.
So what do you expect to happen at this point? This is a contentious move, and we have, you know, some groups, including Planned Parenthood and others, upset about this. What do you think will happen next? Are we going to see litigation?
Well, I would hope that the commissioner would save the Wisconsin taxpayers the dollars of federal litigation and retract its erroneous legal announcement. They're just wrong. But if they're going to persist in this incorrect interpretation of a federal case, then they're asking for litigation, and I would imagine they'll find it.
Are there other aspects of that Hobby Lobby ruling that could be applied to states and used to say that insurers in a state didn't have to cover contraception?
No. Only the standard that the court applies is this extreme standard established by the federal RFRA. So as I say, the only way that a state RFRA, that a state might mirror what the federal court did is by saying that their state RFRA has to be interpreted just like the federal RFRA. There's no requirement of that. That case is not binding on state RFRA interpretation, but they could certainly offer it as persuasive theory.
So given what you've said today, do you expect a lawsuit against the administration to be successful?
Well, you know, I think it's very unusual for a commissioner in a state to issue a ruling that is just flat wrong on the law, not revisit it, and withdraw it. If that doesn't happen, the citizens of Wisconsin can assume that this was actually politically motivated rather than a legal mistake. And in that circumstance, I would expect it would probably be litigation against it because it's unjustifiably denying women contraception, and it's basically a violation of the separation of powers under the Wisconsin Constitution.
Do you see any way in which that litigation would fail and that the state would prevail?
No, I don't. It would require a court to impose on the state of Wisconsin a standard that the state of Wisconsin has not chosen in its statutes. And that would be shocking.
Marcy, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
We've been speaking with Marcy Hamilton, the chair of public law at the Yeshiva School of Law. Her forthcoming book is called God Versus the Gavel, The Perils of Extreme Religious Liberty.
Back in the Middle Ages, stave churches were quite common in Europe. A few of them remain today, mostly in Norway and Sweden. And in today's Curious Wisconsin, we find out there's at least one modern example here in the state.
It's Trinity Evangelical Lutheran Church on Washington Island in Door County, and the Washington Island resident Richard Purinton was involved in its construction. Richard, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, good afternoon, Veronica and Rob.
Well, let's find out what state churches are. Can you describe one for us?
Well, they began, I think, at being posts and ground type construction. In some of the literature, they're called palisade type churches. That was the forerunner of the current style of church. Obviously, the burying a post, pine post or fir post or whatever in the soil meant that it would deteriorate rather quickly. Then they gradually evolved to placing stones in the holes, then laid stone foundations. And around the year 1000 to 1100, about the time that Norway received Christianity, they began to evolve from those posting ground type constructions to a more of a laid stone foundation, and that's the sort of a stave church we have here in Washington Island. Then from those stone foundations, pillars are erected, and it's an almost entirely wood construction.
And you said around the turn of the millennium there, 1000 to 1100 is when these became popular. Did they range mostly in Scandinavia or elsewhere too, do you know?
As far as I know, primarily Norway, with a few in Sweden, although those in Sweden apparently were found to be outdated and they were replaced in later years. So there are only one or two examples left in Sweden. Some similar type construction was found in Denmark. I'm not sure if any currently exist there. And the post and ground type construction was found in other places, such as England, but almost all of those were replaced with stone or different types of structures later on, whereas those in Norway, the ones that survived, and there are about 30 of them today, are excellent examples of stave churches.
Why did they choose that material?
Well, I think primarily because they had a lot of wood. This was in valleys of Norway. These churches were built on prominent hills. I'm picturing these isolated fjords. They may not have been that way in all cases, but that's at least my mental image. Fairly isolated farming valleys, and each would have its own stave church. So somewhere in around 1,300 of these churches existed at one time, but through gradual deterioration down to just 29 or 30 today. But they were good woodworkers, I think, not only building watercraft of wood. They were good wood carvers, or became good wood carvers. And they had just had an abundance of wood. That was probably the easiest material for them to work with.
Before we get to the stave church that you helped build on Washington Island, did Norwegian immigrants bring those over to the United States and maybe Wisconsin say, there's a lot of wood here, this is a good opportunity to bring something from the old country?
As far as I know, they did not bring that style of construction with them. This is something of a much later time period where people are looking back maybe with some nostalgia and looking at the beauty of the existing stave churches in Norway and wanting to recreate that here. There are maybe 10 to a dozen examples that I'm aware of in the U.S., and I've only seen a few of those, and they're all more recently constructed, trying to emulate the old style.
And why did folks on Washington Island decide that they wanted to build one?
I'm not sure that everybody decided it was a great idea, but a pastor at the Trinity Lutheran Church in about the mid-1980s, I think his brother had worked on one in Minnesota. Anyway, he thought it would be a good way to honor Scandinavian heritage on Washington Island, and not everybody here has Norwegian heritage, and few people probably knew what he was referring to. So there was a little bit of a controversy over whether or not funds should be set aside for such a project. But once it was approved, surprisingly, you know, a lot more funds came in. Pretty soon materials were purchased, and by 1991, a foundation was laid.
And how authentic did you all try to be in the construction of this? Did you really try to recreate a church from, you know, about 1,000 years ago?
Well, I think it was a process in which we tried to emulate and come as close as we could. There were no detailed blueprints, so an architect from Sister Bay, Pat Mangan, offered his services to provide some elevations, floor plan, and a material list. and he patterned it after a church in Borgen, Norway. It's not an exact replica, but it's patterned after that. So it has several of these tiers with what I guess I would refer to as dormers, kind of a cake-like layers to it. Verticality is stressed. And in the interior, there are 12 large posts, or you might even call them masts. Those are the staves, the 12 primary structural members of the building, and then the rest of the structure is erected around that. So it was about a three-year process for the construction until the building was dedicated.
What does it feel like to be inside this stave church on Washington Island?
Well, I've been in it many times, and I take tour groups probably 6 to 8 times a week around the island, and that's one of our stops. And I'm always observing people's reactions. And as we head down this path through the woods, some people haven't been paying attention, so they have no idea what it is we're going to see, and others have expectations that are maybe different than what they'll see. And they come out of the woods and see the structure very very pretty, great proportions, kind of a softness to it, and an elegance, and they're overwhelmed by it.
Is it light wood or dark wood?
The wood is light to begin with, but it's been stained with a combination of pine tar and something like linseed oil. It isn't linseed oil, but it's close to that, so it's absorbed into the wood to provide waterproofing, and that has to be reapplied every 5-6 years, otherwise the wood tends to dry out. Photographs that I've seen of the old stave churches that still exist in Norway had a much heavier application of pine tar, and that stuff, I like to equate it to the old style telephone poles where the creosote kind of slumps down to the bottom of the pole over time. This is lighter, and it probably won't do that, but it does dry out in the sun after 5-6 years. It has to be reapplied.
Looking at it from the outside, does it really stand out? Is this all of a sudden you're coming out of the woods and there's this 1,000-year-old, just-converted Vikings sort of building in the middle of nowhere?
Yes, I mean, people really are surprised at it. And, you know, as they're coming down the path, some might say, what is it we're supposed to see again here? You know, they're a little bit bored and maybe restless, and like Americans are when they're on the vacation. And then they see this, and their mood changes. And I invite them inside. It's always open to the public, night and day, year-round, for that matter. And after they've taken a few photos, ask them to please have a seat. There's only room for about 40 people inside. It's quite small. And then I tell them about the history of the church and the construction, and they seem to change during that period of time. Something, you know, it doesn't matter what their background or, you know, I see people from all over the world at these different things, and they all have an interest in what's going on there, and I think a general respect for the building and the construction.
And this is a functioning church, right? Are there actual services there?
Yes, there are. Wednesday evenings in the summer months, I think up to about mid-September, at 7:30 there are services.
Held in Norwegian?
No, they're in English. I don't know if you did it Norwegian, if anyone would understand. They're in English, and you know they might have some guitar or similar instrument, but otherwise there's no church organ, no piano, you know, or a cappella. You know, someone will lead it, pastor of the Lutheran Church or others. But it is a Lutheran church, and then there are also weddings occasionally, but that wasn't really seen as the purpose of the church, partly because, as we found out, when there are weddings there, first of all, it puts it off limits to everyone else for that period of time. And then, secondly, it takes organization to make reservations, and there are deposits, and people change their minds, and it becomes a very commercial type of enterprise. So that was not entirely discouraged, but it's not played up.
Best just to drop in then, it sounds like.
It's open for visitation, meditation, and for people to appreciate it. But if they do wish to get married, they need to make that reservation in advance.
Gotcha. Richard, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you.
That's Washington Island resident Richard Purinton. Few 20th century leaders have inspired people the way Nelson Mandela did. Imprisoned for 27 years, he was released to become South Africa's first democratically elected president, and he steered the country peacefully to majority rule.
His capacity for forgiveness, compassion, and reconciliation made him one of the most remarkable and respected individuals of modern times.
To show his commitment to peace and reconciliation, he actively sought out and interacted with people of different backgrounds, including white Afrikaners who were the ruling class at the time he was imprisoned.
Yet it came as a surprise that he chose as one of his closest aides and confidants a white Afrikaner woman. Zelda LaGrange served as private secretary to Nelson Mandela from 1997 until his death in 2013. She's the author of Good Morning, Mr. Mandela, and she joins us now from Washington, D.C. Zelda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me.
Well, I wonder if you could take us back to the first day when you, as a young secretary, met Nelson Mandela face-to-face. What happened?
Well, I was walking into his private secretary's office, delivering a note to her that I had to type, and this crowd of people came out of her office, and I noticed that Nelson Mandela was amongst them. Immediately, you know, he extended his hand to me, and he started conversing with me. I couldn't understand him at first, and I had to ask him to repeat himself. And it's only then that I realized that he was speaking to me in Afrikaans, my home language, and the language that was considered the oppressor's language. I was so shocked and overtaken by emotion that I broke down and I cried, and he conversed with me for quite some time. I could see the kindness in his face, in his eyes, the sincerity of his smile. And he immediately destroyed my defenses, and he won me over immediately, conversing with me and really being interested in me.
And even in that first interaction, he was very frank with you. He held your hand the whole time this was happening, it sounds like, and he told you were overreacting.
That's right, yes. When he saw me breaking down and not composing myself fast enough, he said to me, no, relax, you are overreacting. Now, if a president tells you you're overreacting, you compose yourself very quickly.
Was that typical of your relationship with him, that combination of warmth from him and also frankness, honesty?
Frankness and honesty, that's right, yes. And I think he appreciated, that we could share a sense of humor in any kind of situation. And that was really the basis of a very good relationship.
Why do you think that he chose you? You were white, you were an Afrikaner. Why did he choose you as one of his closest aides?
Well, it is a combination of things, I think. First of all, you know, I was available to commit myself and dedicate myself to the job, not only 100%, but beyond that. And he recognized my loyalty. Obviously, you know, I didn't know much about my own country's history, but as time progressed, he really took my hand. He taught me so many things. He mentored me in a way, and I think I was available. I was open to all of this, and he appreciated that.
Well, I guess he couldn't have known this, but you came from a household that you consider racist. You grew up as part of a family that referred to Mr. Mandela as a terrorist. How quickly did that change when you started working for him?
Well, the first day, that's why I also chose the title of the book, Good Morning, Mr. Mandela. It indicates the beginning of the change. I started questioning my own beliefs and what I was brought up to believe that day. But it took probably about 2 years, to win me over and to really for me to comprehend where we come from and what apartheid really meant to people like him. So it was a process, you know. He always says, or he said, it's easier to change other people than it is to change yourself. So it really took some time.
Now, you grew closer to him. You were one of his closest secretaries. You managed his schedule. You traveled with him. And there are times when you said that doing that job almost drove you crazy. What was it like at its most frenetic, handling the personal life and the professional life of Nelson Mandela?
Yes, you know what? In the United States, people are used to a large contingent of people around people, heads of state and so on. And we had a very small infrastructure. So absorbing the kind of pressure from the outside world, everyone in the world wanted a piece of Nelson Mandela. So absorbing that kind of pressure was probably the hardest part of the job. And you really had to find ways, creative ways of remaining or keeping your sanity at some point.
And he was said to have had a great sense of humor. And it sounds as though he played some jokes on you. What did he do?
Yes, well, he had his standard teasing jokes, or, you know, cracking jokes with all of us, all of the people in his office. He would always find something funny, or even when we traveled abroad, he would speak to me in Afrikaans and really just make funny remarks and comments about the environment. So there was always time for a bit of humor, and he had a great sense of humor, and I really hope to share that part of him in the book with the rest of the world.
Now, you traveled with him, as I said, and one of the places that you went, I gather, sort of early on was to the Middle East, and he had barely been out of South Africa, and you hadn't either. The two of you were sort of babes in the wood as you began some of these early travels, and one of the things that President Mandela wanted to do was to tour Mecca. And you almost did. What happened?
Yes, I recited the story this afternoon to someone else from the Middle East. You know what? We had a few days to spare in the Middle East, and he decided that he wanted to visit Mecca and Medina. And I was busy arranging this visit, not thinking anything of it, and communicating with the protocol people when they announced to me that I would not be able to accompany him. And when I asked why not, they said because I wasn't Muslim. So it was very funny because they thought he was Muslim, and that was one of the greatness or the great things about the man is he could relate so well to people and associate so well with people that people actually believed he was one of them. Irrespective of conviction and religion and so on, that was just his way. So unfortunately we couldn't visit when I announced that he wasn't actually Muslim. You know, they canceled the visit.
Yeah, sounds like he almost did, though, because he convinced people, you know, with his understanding that he really
Absolutely.
Understood.
Yes, that's right.
And there's another story I wonder if you could tell, which really gets at sort of how unshakable he seems to have been, his character. You were escorting him with I gather, a group of other people in cars, armored cars and such, to lunch with Morgan Freeman. And on the way there, someone in your motorcade gets hit. And
yes.
And yet he seems like he wasn't so bothered by what happened. What happened
yes.
that day?
You know what? It is also a way of explaining to the world how shielded he was by all these layers and layers of people around him. And the security, I mean, we were in a full-on accident with his cavalcade, with his convoy, but he didn't notice anything, and he was totally unshaken by the events. Yet when we arrived, Morgan and his business partner, Laurie, could clearly see that we were visibly all in shock. But he was protected from all of that by the people around him, really.
Was that a good thing? All of the time, or most of the time, or were there times when that shield around him became too much and maybe harmed him?
Yes, I do think that to some extent, you know, a person like that, and it's not unique to him, it's to all people in that kind of position, you know, that they sometimes tend to lose touch with reality. You know, they don't know, Mr. Mandela, for one, didn't know the living costs of, you know, normal living costs of people because it was never part of his daily life or daily challenges, you know, to go to the shop and buy a bread. You know, those normal things, I think, you know, they evade people in that position. So you can very easily lose touch with reality. Although I think, you know, we managed to make sure that that from time to time he was, you know, the normality of life was introduced to him in some way.
He was friends with an incredible number of significant people, from, you know, Queen Elizabeth. I guess he was on first name terms with her. Is that right?
That's right. Yes, I think he's the only one in the world that was on first names with her. He called her Elizabeth, and at one occasion, when he saw her, he said to her, "Oh, Elizabeth, you look well. It looks like you lost weight." No, not everyone in the world gets to tell the Queen of England that she lost weight. And when he was asked by his wife, Mrs. Grasa Machel, when he was almost reprimanded, and she said, it was not proper for him to call the Queen of England Elizabeth. He said, but she's calling me Nelson. So that was, they really shared a very warm friendship.
Hmm. And he knew a lot of other notable people. He enjoyed music, for one thing. He was friends with some musicians. And we have a clip of Mr. Mandela at a 1999 Johnny Clegg and Savuka concert in his honor. And here he is talking about what music means to him.
Well, it is music and dancing that makes me at peace with the world. And at peace with myself. But I don't see much movement at the back there, you know? I would like us to join. Let's just repeat. Let's just repeat it. Let's all join.
We're talking with Zelda LaGrange, who served as a personal aide to Nelson Mandela for over a decade. Her memoir about her experience is called Good Morning, Mr. Mandela.
We'd like to hear from you. Has Nelson Mandela's life story affected you personally in some way? Are you curious about what he was like in person and as a person? What would you like to ask his former secretary about him? You can call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email talk@WPR.org or tweet Central Time WPR. We continue our conversation with Zelda LaGrange, personal aide to late South African President Nelson Mandela. She's just written a book about working closely with the iconic leader for over a decade. The book is Good Morning, Mr. Mandela.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. Has Nelson Mandela's life story affected you personally? Are you curious about what he was like as a person, what it was like to work so closely with him? Maybe questions about the end of his life. You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. And Zelda, I want to ask you about those later years. He seemed to have been surrounded by feuding family, doctors, people with political agendas. Looking back now, what do you wish could have been done differently for him?
Well, you know what? My advice to anyone of power, aging, and realizing, you know, that age is a huge factor to be reckoned with in future. You know, I'm specifically talking about people with power and so on. Is set rules and regulations around you whilst you are still able to. I think, you know, we were in a way left powerless, not being able to deal with all the eventuality around Mr. Mandela as he aged. Things were very unpleasant towards the end. But now, you know, I mean, we learned through it, and there's nothing you can do now. It doesn't help one to regret anything in life, because you can't change the fact that these things happen. But it was unpleasant towards the end.
When you say very unpleasant, what happened? What did you see?
Well, you know what? There was a lot of infighting. It's a large, very complex family that he was part of, and the infighting really overshadowed our daily lives. And then also, you know, people weren't clear on how to deal with the eventuality of his death. Obviously, you know, it was an unprecedented event in the world, his death and his funeral, but people weren't well organized, and that played its part, or that actually I describe it as leaking out, poison leaking out in all of our lives.
Hmm. Well, you found out later, after he'd passed, that you were actually banned from seeing him at the end of his life. Do you wish that you had been able to be with him at the end?
Not right to the end. You know, I think that is a space for one's family. But I would have liked to see him closer to the end, at least. You know, now knowing how ill he really was, or how sick he was shortly before his death, perhaps it was a blessing in a way that I didn't see him right to the end. But, you know, I saw him the last time on the 11th of July last year, and it's more than a year ago now. And probably, I mean, I don't know, that's the way of life, but, you know, if I could see him later, could have seen him a bit later, you know, you always want to say more, and you never think that it's the last time when you see anyone. But now I'm content with things, you know, these things all happen for a reason, although I may not understand it right now.
Now, one of the things that you wonder toward the end, as these reports came, and we heard them all, you know, over the radio and the news, that doctors were keeping him alive on life support, you wondered yourself why he was lingering. Was he not choosing to pass on? Was he afraid of death? Did you ever get an answer to that?
No, I didn't. And you know what? I don't think we ever will. I recently saw one of his daughters actually commenting that he was suffering, which was, you know, what we feared for. But you're not in that position. As a, you know, I'm not a medical practitioner, and I assume that if you're in that position to be responsible for a person like that, you will try anything possible to keep him alive. I don't know what else one would do as a professional. So it also, you know, it doesn't help to blame anyone right now.
Now, you call him Kulu, which I gather means grandfather.
That's right.
To what degree did you feel that he was a grandfather, that he was family?
Yes, you know what, if you spend so much time with someone, I mean, 16 out of the 19 years that I worked for him, we traveled day and night. So I probably spent more time with him than you would when you bring up a child, because that child goes off to school at some point, and you stop spending so much time together. But we work together every day, we travel together every day, so it's a lot of time, and it's a natural process that a close relationship would evolve if you spend that much time with someone.
Now, you spent so much time with him that I can't imagine all the memories you must have, and especially with someone who led such an extraordinary life. But when you think back over your time with him, is there any one memory that rises to the surface as one that was especially sweet, one that you cherish particularly?
Yes, you know, there's so many, as you say, as you rightly point out. But because it's the last memory, probably the day I visited him in hospital and, you know, he gave me that bright smile and he fixed his eyes on me, that was a very special time. And then you referred to it earlier when we were traveling overseas and he would crack a joke about something around us and he would speak to me in Afrikaans. Those light-hearted moments, you know, they will stay with me forever.
How would you say that he changed you?
Well, generally speaking, the way I relate to people, you know, every day, to anyone around me, that has changed significantly. If I think back of the 23-year-old that started working in his office, I can't recognize that person. That is really the impact of his presence in my life. You know, just dealing with people with a bit more respect, and there's so many life lessons really that I can take from him. But the way you relate to people, irrespective of the color of their skin or their wealth or status in society, I think that's part of the greatness of the man.
Hmm. Did you have a sense over the years whether he, especially the later years, I guess, what he thought about the political direction that South Africa was headed in?
Yes, you know what, he remained a loyal member of the African National Congress, so he never to be divided from that party, but things worried him, you know, things like the lack of quality education to our children, corruption. Those are things not only in the later years, but things that he was concerned about throughout his life. And it's just in the last few years, I think we've seen an increase of something like corruption in the South African government. And he was not aware of everything around him as he became old. You know, we shielded him from a lot of that, specifically not to worry him and so that he's not concerned about these things. But those are the things, you know, that he was opposed against, specifically corruption, dishonesty, and so on. So, that, you know, if he was aware of it, he would be deeply worried.
Mm. We talked earlier about his relationship with notable figures in the world, Queen Elizabeth among them. Another one was former President Bill Clinton. They had a pretty significant friendship. Can you tell us what that was like between the two men?
Yes, there was a deep sense of respect between the two men, an appreciation, a mutual appreciation for each other. Also, President Clinton, every year during Mr. Mandela's birthday month in July, President Clinton would arrange his travels to South Africa or to Africa to be close to Mr. Mandela around his birthday. So it was really, Mr. Mandela considered him almost as his son.
Hmm. That's remarkable. So did President Clinton play a role toward the end of his life as well?
No, I think President Clinton saw him also about a year and a half before his passing. So he wasn't able to see him after that.
Now, moving back into the personal scope of his life, you say that this was someone who had a lot of, not just a lot, an incredible amount of esteem the world over, but he wasn't materialistic. He only had a few objects that were very precious to him. Could you tell us about what they were and why?
Yes, his favorite pen, he called it a presidential pen. His walking stick, which was from pure ivory, made from an elephant, a friend of his, a gentleman by the name of Dostein, has a game farm to the north of where Mr. Mandela lived in Johannesburg. And there was an elephant bull that passed away. The elephant bull was called Madiba, which is also Mr. Mandela's clan name. So when the elephant passed away, they actually used his tusk to make an ivory walking stick for Mr. Mandela. So that was one of his prized possessions. And then, his wrist watch, which was really just an antique. And his wedding ring, as I say, and the holder in which he kept his reading glasses. But those were the only things he was... He ever paid attention to, he wasn't much, he didn't pay attention to material things at all.
And I gather his walking stick went missing. Was it ever found?
No, it wasn't. We don't know, I don't want to make accusations to say someone really stole it or whether it was just misplaced. But you can't mistake it for anything else. And that's why I also went into great detail describing the walking stick in the book, because if it ever surfaces or someone tries to sell it, I hope it would be returned to the family or to his widow, because it was really something that actually should have gone with him to the grave. He was so attached to that walking stick.
Zelda, do you still think about him every day?
Yes, I do. Actually, I do. I'm as you said earlier, I'm in D.C. now, and I went to Georgetown to have lunch with someone this afternoon, and I drove past the Four Seasons Hotel, and the last time I was in Washington, we stayed at the Four Seasons Hotel. So there's memories all around me and that remind me of him every single day.
Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Zelda LaGrange, who served as private secretary to Nelson Mandela from 1997 to his death in 2013. She's the author of the new memoir, Goodnight, Mr. Mandela.